Well, thank you to the organizers for putting this meeting together. This is a continuation of essentially of a talk I gave in late of March in an earlier workshop on the theory of highly oscillatory problems. So this time I will be more focused on the fluids. So the outline is roughly as follows. First of all, I should explain what the Mach number is. Also, I assume that most of you will know it. So the Mach number is the epsilon in this talk, the small parameter. Then I want to give you some or one particular motivation why simply letting m go to zero and looking at the incompressible limit is not always the right thing to do, and it has to do with the effect of light hill radiation. And so that serves as a motivation that you really want to have algorithms that work in the limit m to zero, but also for small Mach numbers. So this is the problem of Mach uniform algorithms. And then finally, I basically want to propose what our approach now is to achieve this, and then some implementation issues related to this approach. Okay, so the Euler equations, I assume at some stage all of you have seen. So I like to write them down here in the conservation form. So we have conservation of mass, momentum, and energy. And energy is kinetic energy, so to speak, plus potential energy. And then to close the equations, you need some relation that relates the internal energy to the pressure. And in this case, here we assume that we have an ideal gas. So, and I already scaled all the variables, so I made them non-dimensional. So there's the Mach number appears then as a crucial parameter. And the Mach number is a ratio of the flow velocity, so advection or convection velocities, versus the speed of sound. And so in this talk, we assume that the speed of sound is much faster than the advection in the problem, right? So that essentially means that for example, shocks are not really relevant to this. And so then you let m go to zero.
Sorry?
Yeah?
Question, you had an epsilon on this slide. What is it?
An epsilon?
Calligraphic E.
Oh, this here. This is the energy, specific energy. What is the proper name? It's not the internal. What is this? It's the. No, no, it's not the entropy. The potential energy density, but what do you call it in fluids? Slipped my memory now.
That's internal energy, no?
Yeah, the internal energy, yes. Isn't that the name? Yes, internal energy. Energy density, right? Internal, yes, the internal energy density. Okay. So anyway, so here the Mach number appears in front of the pressure, and so if you let that go to zero, then to get a bounded derivative in the velocities, then obviously the pressure has to be of the form that you can have a constant of order one, which potentially can depend on time but shouldn't depend on space. And then the next term should be of order m square. So it's relatively small. And furthermore, if you plug it into the second equation, you see that because this term now, there's no derivative here, so that the p naught survives, whereas here and here, it becomes of order m square. In the limit, this term should go to zero. And this gives you the incompressibility assumption or in the limit. And so the velocity field then can be decomposed into an order one velocity field, which should be incompressible plus a small perturbation. Okay, so this is the standard way, at least to ad hoc, derive the incompressible Euler equations out of the compressible ones. And we will, this expansion will play a role later in the talk again and again. So two observations are that we're talking about Euler equations, so there's no viscosity, the equations are reversible. They also, of course, Hamiltonian, but in this context, I will particularly focus on the reversibility. And you can linearize about a motionless reference state, and you get the acoustic wave equation with essentially the speed of sound unscaled variables, undimensionalized variables. And we have assumed that rho naught and t naught are all constant, so the reference state is constant density here. Okay. So you could say, well, if the Mach number is small, then let's just go to the incompressible limit and let's work with these equations. And of course, that's often done, and it's very useful and very. But there's one effect that you potentially miss. That's the Lytle. It's associated with the name of Lytle. Essentially, what happens is that you can decompose this P2 into the pressure you get from the incompressibility assumption. So this part of the pressure satisfies incompressibility, so the divergence of the velocity field or the time derivative that should then be zero. And so you get this elliptic equation for this incompressible equation, plus a perturbation for finite m. And so that can be rearranged. You can basically derive an equation for this perturbation, which has on the left-hand side the wave equation again, as we just seen it, and source terms. And the source terms are essentially associated with the incompressible motion. So it's sort of a wave equation driven by terms that are entirely determined, essentially to leading order, by the incompressible fluid flow. Okay, so what happens with this? This is here where the multiscale effect comes in. Of course, if you look at waves or acoustic, I mean, these are sort of acoustic waves here, acoustic waves of order, length scale of order 1, then because there's an m square here, they're very fast. This is here of order 1, so you have something very fast. This is slow. So you assume that you can conclude that basically the source term will not excite fast waves if they're not there initially. But because we're here in the PDE context, you can then think of waves of increasing length or decreasing wave number. And in particular, if you then go up to the length of order 1 over m, then this suddenly becomes actually something slow. So it becomes of a time scale that's the same as the driving. And then you can have resonance interactions. And so the source term then can excite acoustic waves, long wave length acoustic waves, and the wavelength will be of the order of 1 over m. And that phenomena was first, was carefully discussed by Lytle in 52. And basically implies that the incompressible limit is certainly correct on length scale of order 1, the choice of our non-dimensional variables. But if you think your domain being very, very large on a very long length scale, it's not appropriate. Okay, so that's basically summarized here again what I just explained, that essentially if that ratio holds, then there are potentially resonant interactions and the excitation of waves from the vortical mean flow. This wave generation is weak, but it has a fixed power in Q, and that effect essentially prevents the existence sort of a quotation mark slow manifold like we know it from ODEs. Like if you think about the talk that Bob gave yesterday where he said, well, if you have stiff springs and then in the limit you might go over to the constraints, that would be the incompressible approximation here. And then you can actually do asymptotic expansion. You can prove that there's a slow manifold under idealized assumptions to all orders. Well, essentially, that doesn't work here because of this effect that unless, I guess, you assume a bounded domain, you will have this Lytle effect, and that will allow waves to be radiated from the mean flow. So this problem has been discussed, actually, in several contexts. Jacques Vanesse pointed out, I think, that it appears apparently already in a publication by Einstein in 1918, where he discussed gravity wave generation in general relativity. Don't ask me about the details there. Then it certainly also appears in combustion theory, combustion phenomena or combustion instabilities. There are probably more reference than I give here, but I learned it from a paper by Klein, Rupert Klein in Potsdam, and then Wein and Yi. My first encounter was actually in the context of atmospheric fluid dynamics, where Michael McIntyre has done a work with his student Rupert Ford, and they carefully studied the phenomena for rotating flows and did a lot of numerical experiments, and they are very nice. I mean, you can really see how a little vortex, spinning vortex, which has a length scale of order one, can generate gravity waves, which are have a length scale of 1 over m. And then there are also some studies in the context of coupled ODE-PDE systems. Well, Edward Lorenz did, and more recently, Jacques Vanest. Studied the same phenomena. Okay, so anyway, so you would like to have a numerical algorithm that basically can capture Lytle radiation, but also avoids sort of step size limitations that come from the fact that you keep the fluid compressible, right? Clearly, if you keep the fluid compressible, then you have to use a very, very small time step associated with the Mach number, with the smallness of the Mach number. So you want to have an algorithm that essentially in the right domain behaves like an incompressible solver, and in large scale flows becomes compressible, behaves like a compressible solver. So this has given rise to the notion of Mach uniform algorithms. Of course, there are also other motivations why you want to have such algorithms. For example, that you don't want to have a whole set of algorithms, one for incompressible, one for compressible, and for different Mach numbers. So you would like to have just one algorithm doing it all. And that has a long history, of course, as you might expect it. And it all starts in the 60s. And I just list here a few approaches. So there are the semi-implicit methods, which were pioneered in the context of geophysical fluid dynamics by Robert in the late 60s, and then the first major publication in 71. Very closely related are the methods that were devised in a different community, the pressure correction methods, first proposed by Harlow. Basically, the idea is that you say, okay, the source of the stability constraint are the fast fluctuation in the pressure, and so you treat those in a way not fully implicit, but you sort of do a predictor correcting approach to keep those stable in a way. The disadvantage of this approach is that you typically lose the reversibility of the equation. So, they're prone to instabilities through the discretization. And then you basically fix this by introducing damping again. So the same implicit method is hugely popular even today with the meteorological community. The UK Met Office is using them, Canadian, French. But there's this issue of instabilities and being cured then by excessive damping is certainly a major issue, especially as the resolutions are getting higher and higher. So there's currently a tendency to actually say, well, semi-implicit is like just doing one iteration towards a fully implicit method. So let's do a few more iterations and think of it really as a discretization in the sense of Crank-Nicholson or implicit midpoint, perhaps. And the first person who proposed this in the meteorology community was Coté. That, of course, increases expenses, not quite by a factor of two, but it makes it more expensive. But it cures most of the instability problems that the first approach has. And finally, there's a third approach that is basically saying that you can try to fix the stability problem by saying, well, let's do some preconditioning. So you have a differential equation, and you pre-multiply it by an appropriate matrix. This goes back to Turin, and then Browning and Christ did some work in this direction, and Van Leer. But essentially, what generally happens that it of course, you keep the stationary states, but it tends to corrupt not only the fast. I mean, it does not only change the fast dynamics, but it generally corrupts also slow dynamics. So in a way, this approach, I don't think, has become very popular. Okay, so now the approach we've been following recently is essentially having a look at what the semi-implicit method really tries to do, but to avoid any level of discretization at that stage, really trying to understand it on the level of the equations. And then only once you fix all that, then to say, now let's discretize. And I sort of to separate these two issues of getting a well-posed set of equations you can work with and then discretize. And the idea is embarrassingly simple. Basically, what we do is we take the original equations, all we say, and that really comes, of course, the idea comes from the fact that somehow you have to do something about pressure. So you replace the pressure as it's given by the ideal gas law by P hat, which is a correction of that pressure. And we call it the regularization. Otherwise, you keep all the physics in there, right? I mean, it's just changing essentially the way you change the way the fluids interact with, the fluid particles interact with each other, but they still, you have energy conservation, you have mass conservation, you have momentum conservation, all the physics is still there. You just go away slightly from the ideal gas, essentially. And the ideal gas often is a simplifying assumption anyway. Of course, you don't want to be too brutal about it. So, you want to have a regularization that does as little change to the potential to the pressure as necessary. Okay, so let's introduce some notation. So we have divergence, the delta here, and its time derivative. So I denote this by in this form. And of course, for an incompressible fluid, this would be zero, and this should be zero. And then we introduce the following elliptic equation to get this pressure correction or regularized pressure. So on the on this side, you have a source term, so to speak. You have a parameter alpha, which is tunable. I will say in a minute how to choose it. Gamma is a ratio of the gas constant and the specific enthalpy, or two constants. I keep forgetting. And this is pressure. And here you have this change in divergence, the time derivative of, or the approximate time derivative of the pressure, of the divergence. So ideally, this would be zero. So if you're incompressible, the velocity field is incompressible, then then this would be zero. And then you would, of course, have P hat equal to P. And if it's not, then you basically, on this side, you have this modified Helmholtz problem. So you filter, obviously, with this by inverting this operator. You filter the P. Okay, so for incompressible flows, P is equal to P hat. So in the limit M to 0, you won't do anything. Furthermore, the regularized equations with this particular regularization here, they're still reversible. So you haven't introduced any diffusion by doing so. So it's a dispersive regularization. And most importantly, you have reduced all the frequencies below a threshold, which is determined by this 1 over alpha. So alpha is a time scale. And it's basically the time scale you choose. You say, well, that's the time scale I want to resolve. Everything that's faster than that is irrelevant. So it's what I guess Bob called yesterday stiff oscillatory. You allow to work with the assumption that even though it's oscillatory, the very high frequency stuff for whatever flows you're interested in, you don't need to resolve. So you do compress those. So the spectrum is sort of pushed together, but the monotonicity is actually kept, right? So you don't, it's like what the trapezoidal rule would do to an harmonic, to a chain of harmonic oscillators. If you look at the equation, then the regularization equation, if M becomes of order 1, then this is a small number then, and so this removes itself, and fiddling around with it a little bit, one can actually see that in that case there's no regularization, which makes sense. So the regularization removes itself as the Mach number goes up to 1. And in the limit M to 0, if you then use this decomposition of the pressure again in the incompressible part plus the perturbation, you see then one can show that basically the regularization equation reduces to that. So the regularization only works on the perturbation. And then there are two possibilities. Either the ratio of sound to reference is of order 1. So the length scale for this perturbation is order 1. Then this has a major impact. So it basically filters it all out. So even if there is something in the what you get from the ideal gas law, the actual pressure using in the fluid is then eliminating. So you really reduced it incompressible fluid. So on that length scale, it really behaves like an incompressible solver, or the pressure is the incompressible pressure. And in case it's this has very long scale, then the M cancels by taking the derivatives here. So this actually then removes itself. This part goes away, and this becomes dominant. So you have P hat equal to P, and so you leave this perturbation intact, and you can capture the Lytle regime, right? So it does exactly what you want. So finally, quickly, the discretization. We're basically using Sturm-Weil. So we think of it as a Lagrangian fluid. So this is a material derivative. And so all you need to do is basically think of this being a force. So the force is being replaced by a regularized force. You can do stability analysis, which then tells you choose alpha larger than delta T a half, or delta T smaller than 2 times alpha, because you do Lagrangian fluid dynamics, and you want to put it onto back onto the grid, you have to use the semi-Lagrangian method. But I think I don't want to go through the details here. It's just an example. It's a warm bubble above a cold bubble, a small cold bubble in the warm bubble. And so this is sort of 1 kilometer, this is 1 kilometer. The mesh size is very small, it's 5 meters. And so the step size I've chosen here is actually 100 times larger than what the CFL condition for the acoustic modes would dictate. And you see here the warm bubble starts rising, the cold one sort of drops slightly, and then it gets all mixed up and you get incredible complicated contours. That's why you need this high resolution, but it's essentially vortical motion. I mean, there's no sound waves being here generated or anything. So you could, in principle, actually also just use an incompressible solver here, but it's just to show that the method is able to behave like an incompressible solver, even though you don't enforce incompressibility explicitly. Okay, to summarize, I've put everything here into the simple context of the Euler equations with sort of no background stratification. Everything becomes a bit more complicated if you put in source terms like gravitation or rotation, but it's really technical, so I want to save you from that. But it's all in these papers. We can, in principle, also build into the regularization fluctuation dissipation terms, basically saying that these high waves are not properly resolved anymore. So you really have to parameterize them, quotation mark. Because we work first with the equations and they have all the conservation properties we had with the original equations, we can then discretize them in a conservative manner, especially conserve mass, which is quite a big issue in meteorology. And in fact, you can use similar ideas in molecular dynamics, of course. It's, you could also work basically saying we don't enforce constraints rigorously, but we use this sort of regularization idea. So that would mean that the bonded forces get sort of mollified, but you actually sort of allow oscillations about, you still allow a sort of oscillations, so you don't enforce constraints hardwired. And that has advantage that you have just to solve a linear equation, and the system itself is still time reversible. So it's like a linearly implicit method. And Tobias Hundertmark is looking at this. And with this, I finish. Thank you.